The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri at the library with the Poet Laureate of the United States, Robert Haas. I would like to be the 1,000th person to welcome you.
Thank you, Grace.
Welcome.
It's a
and
pleasure.
I cannot think of a better way to introduce you to the world than to have you do it with an opening poem in your own voice. Here's Robert Haas.
Concerning the afterlife, the Indians of Central California had only the dimmest notions.
And you're saying that while looking for the poem. I'm impressed.
It is morning because the sun has risen. I wake slowly in the early heat, pick berries from the thorny vines. They are deep red, sugar heavy, fuzzed with dust. The eucalyptus casts a feathered shadow on the house, which gradually withdraws. After breakfast, you will swim, and I am going to read that hard man Thomas Hobbes on the causes of the English Civil Wars. There are no women in his world, Hobbes, brothers fighting brothers over goods. I see you in the later afternoon, your hair dry yellow, plaited from the waves, a faint salt sheen across your belly and along your arms. The kids bring from the sea intricate calcium gifts, black turbans, angular green whelks, the whorled opalescent unicorn. We may or may not feel some irritation at the dinner hour. The first stars, and after dark, Vega hangs in the lyre. The dipper tilts above the hill. Traveling in Europe, Hobbes was haunted by motion. Sailing or riding, he was suddenly aware that all things move. We will lie down, finally, in our heaviness, and touch and drift toward morning.
The voice of Robert Haas. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Robert Haas is our Poet Laureate, consultant in poetry. He was born in San Francisco, took his undergraduate degree at St. Mary's College, and his graduate degrees at Stanford University. He was reading from Field Guide, his first book. His other collections are Praise, Essays, which are 20th Century Pleasures, Human Wishes, The Essential Haiku, and he has worked with many translations, which we will find out about. Last night, you said that imagination makes communities.
Yes, I said that.
You did. Now, what did you mean?
Well, I said that in connection with the poem I just read. And what I had in mind, I wrote that poem, I guess, in the late, must have been the early 70s. One of the things I was thinking about in the years of the civil rights movement in the Vietnam War was the ways in which our imagination of Western polities, I guess is the word, had gone wrong. And so I set myself the task of trying to read through some of the thinkers like Hobbes who give us our ways of thinking about government. And the first thing that struck me about our democratic capitalist ways of thinking about societies is that they always begin in the idea of some Robinson Crusoe figure, some male appropriating and changing property, and then building up into notions of men in competition with each other over the world's goods, which then of course, Adam Smith picked up and said, ah, but this is a magical system. Everything turns out fine. Prices get set. People get the best goods, so on. It's an imagination of the world in which it's guys competing with each other over goods.
Yes, you said markets make networks.
That's right.
But imagination, which is more human, makes the community, the spirit, I guess.
Yeah, I would say it a little differently, but the market makes networks. I think real markets, in fact, do make communities because people don't behave according to the rules of economic rationalities.
And they too
in
are
real markets.
The product of thought forms,
yeah,
which is what you advocate.
Yeah, they're product of affections and imaginations. You know, the kind of stuff you do when you have a clean exchange with somebody makes a certain kind of relationship. The first real philosopher of the market system, Jeremy Bentham, said, "The perfect participant in a market is a man perfectly rational, perfectly selfish, and perfectly free." That's not how we behave, nor would it be desirable to behave that way.
It's not a bad thing to have you in Washington, you know. And you claim that you might be able to lobby for American writers and for the mind and heart.
Mm-hmm.
Not a bad thing, I think. His name is Robert Hass. I am Grace Cavalieri, and we're going to move on with another poem.
Mm-hmm. Well, what to read? This is a poem, because it's recent, that I'll read. It goes on a bit. But it makes this point from another angle altogether. You know, not only do we not, this is going to make it sound like poetry has a moral purpose, and I don't really think it does. So I'll read the poem without making my speech, except to say, not only do we live in families, not on islands, that's where human polity starts, we live among other creatures. Iowa City, early April. I'd never lived in the Midwest before, and so this is a record of that experience. This morning, a cat, bright orange, pawing at the one patch of new grass in the sand and tan bark colored leaves. And last night, the sapphire of the raccoon's eyes and the beam of the flashlight, he was climbing a tree beside the house, trying to get onto the porch, I think, for a wad of oatmeal simmered in cider from the bottom of the pan we'd left out for the birds. And earlier, a burnished, somewhat dazed woodchuck, his coat gleaming with spring, loping toward his burrow in the roots of a tree among the drying winter's litter of old leaves on the floor of the woods when I went out to get the New York Times. And male cardinals were whistling back and forth, sreep, 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 sets of three sweet full notes weaving into and out of each other like the triplet rhymes in medieval poetry, and the higher, purer notes of the tufted titmice among them, high in the trees where they were catching what they could of the early sun. And a doe and two yearlings picking their way along the worrying path they'd made through the gully, their coats the color of the forest floor. They stopped just at the root of the great chestnut where the woodchuck's burrow was, froze, and the doe looked back over her shoulder at me for a long moment and leapt forward, her young following, and bounded with that almost mincing precision in the landing of each hoof up the gully, over it, and out of sight. So that I remembered dreaming last night that a deer walked into the house while I was writing at the kitchen table, came in the glass door from the garden, looked at me with the still, defiant terror like a thing with no choices, and neck bobbing in that fragile-seeming, almost mechanical mix of arrest and liquid motion, came to the table and snatched a slice of apple and stood, and then quietened, and to my surprise, did not leave again. And those swift little captains, the chickadees, quick to the feeder and quick away. And the squirrels with their smoke plume tails trailing, digging in the leaves to bury or find buried. I'm told they don't remember where they put things, that it's an activity of incessant discovery, nuts, tree fall proteins, whatever they forage from around the house of our leavings. And the flame-headed woodpecker at the suet with his black and white ladderback elegant fierceness, they take sunflower seeds and stash them in the rough ridges of the tree's bark where the beaks of the smoke and steel blue nuthatches can't quite get them, though the nuthatches sometimes seem to get them as they con the tree methodically for spiders' eggs or some other overwintering insect's intricately packaged lump of futurity got from its body before the cold came on. and the little bat in the kitchen light well. When I climbed in a chair to remove the sheet of wimpled plastic and let it loose, it flew straight into my face, and I toppled to the floor chair under me, and it flared down the hall and did what seemed a frantic reconnoiter of the windowed, high-walled living room and lit on a brass fire log where it looked like a brown and ash-gray teenaged suede glove with Mephistophelian dreams, and then spurt of black sperm up out the window and into the twilight woods. All this life going on about my life, or living a life about all this life going on, being a creature, whatever my drama of the moment, at the edge of the raccoon's world. He froze in my flashlight beam and looked down, no affect, just looked. The ringtail curled and flared to make him look bigger and not to be messed with. I was thinking he couldn't know how charming his comic book robber's mask was to me, that his experience of his being and mine of his and his of mine were things entirely apart, though both probably energies of shrewd and respectful tact, bottomed perhaps in fear. I know about his talons, whatever he knows about me. And as for my experience of myself, that comes and goes. I'm not sure it's any one thing, as my experience of them is not. And I know I am often too much with myself and too near, glad to be rid of myself, which is why it is such a happiness, the bright orange of the cat and the first pool of green grass leaves in early April and the bird song, orange and green, not colors you'd set next to one another in a human scheme. And the crow's call before you open your eyes at sunup.
I'm from West Virginia, so I'm grateful. The voice of Robert Hass. I'm very glad you chose that poem because it's a very good demonstration of something I feel about your work. In that field guide was certainly much with the deer, the serenity, in a tumultuous time. In the early 70s, you had this extreme quieting at the center in that book. And it was an absorption in nature with that attention to detail, which we see in this later work. Actually, it's a premiere, I would say, on radio, this poem, perhaps. So it's that new. And yet there seems to be less self in this poem and more of everything else. Do you agree?
In this poem, yes. Well,
your work has moved that way.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, of course, everything anybody writes is drenched in the self because language is, but you can try to use it to represent what doesn't belong to the self entirely.
This experience was totally mine and not Robert Hass's, and I guess that's what I mean, which is quite a miracle, I think. This will be part of a new book we don't know about yet. We don't even know the title.
That's right.
Oh, good.
I wish I knew the title.
Last night at your reading, your premiere, you said, out of self-delusion comes poetry, and you talked about this precious delusion. Where is that reference in your own work?
I was quoting Milosz. There's a wonderful poem of his, of this astonishing poet of the century, now in his 80s, and in the most recent book, Facing the River, he includes a poem which I translated with him called Report, in which he checks in with the higher powers on what it's been like to be a poet. It begins, "O Most High, you willed to create me a poet, and now it's time for me to present a report. My heart is full of gratitude, though I got acquainted with the miseries of my profession." And goes on to say, "By practicing it, we learn too much about the bizarre nature of man, who every hour, every day, and every year is possessed by self-delusion. A self-delusion building sandcastles, collecting postage stamps, admiring oneself in a mirror, assigning oneself first place in sport and power and love and the getting of money. All the while," so on. He goes on and ends, "out of self-delusion comes poetry, and poetry confesses the flaw." And then ends, I don't know that a poem should be manhandled this way, but for our purposes, "It's sweet, I think, that I was a companion in an expedition that never ceases, though centuries pass away. An expedition not in search of the golden fleece of a perfect form, under the compulsion of the desire for the essence of the oak, of the mountain peak, of the wasp, of the slow flowering of nasturtiums, so that they last and make a hymnic song against death. How then, at the end of the poem, could I not be grateful if early I was called and the incomprehensible contradiction has not diminished my wonder? At every sunrise I renounce the doubts of night and greet the new day of this most precious delusion. I left out the middle part, which is in a way the most fun, when he says, how could people as monstrously behaved as poets possibly do this kind of work? He says, though only by remembering poems, where is that? He says, and yet the poet, this master, cannot bear another poet around him if he suspects him of being better than himself and envies him every scrap of praise. He's ready not only to kill him, but to pulverize and obliterate him from the surface of the earth, so that he stands alone, magnanimous and kind toward his subjects who chase after their small self-delusions.
But in spite of our pettiness, he says, we go on to make that beautiful sound, which you call singing.
Yeah.
And this is a very good poem also for you to use as a signature of your own work, mm-hmm. not only as translator, but because you have certainly been identified as a poet who is not a nihilist,
mm-hmm.
who is certainly not going to acknowledge death, mm-hmm. death. Mm-hmm. And this has brought you much wonder from critics and comments, because your own work is so much in praise
mm-hmm.
of our life and our poetry
mm-hmm.
and the berries and the deer. And I have been reading O'Neill's Lazarus Laughed,
mm-hmm.
very little known play. Lazarus wakes up and laughs at Caesar, and laughs because he knows there is no death. And of course, he's not treated really well about that. And in a way, your poetry laughs at people who will be talking about that dark other
mm-hmm.
as the wall you hit.
Mm-hmm.
Have you gotten scored or rapped on the knuckles for that laughter?
Yeah, to some extent I have, I guess. I always feel like I've been misread when that's so. What I think about praise or dispraise of existence in poetry, I guess, is that to do either, to praise or dispraise, truly, can you still use that word in postmodern
when culture? You're the poet laureate of the United States, you can.
Yes, maybe.
You may make it fashionable,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah. I think that to praise or dispraise, to enchant or disenchant, both of which functions art has, you have to include a lot of the one if you're going to do the other. I think poetry that says yes has to swallow great gobbets of darkness, and poetry that says no has to say no in the face of the fact that there must be reasons why the poet has chosen to continue to live in order to say it. I always think in this connection of Monet, because I read that his water lily paintings were begun as a response to reports he had read of the dead in the trenches in the First World War.
Have you used that in a poem?
No, I haven't used it in a poem. I think it's already there. It doesn't need to be, you know, but I was very, the reason those paintings seem to us so supremely great and not wallpaper is that they're full of the dead. They're full of all those colors are full of the colors of the bodies in the trenches as he imagined them. Poetry that praises the world has to have immense ballast. Milos is a poet who all his life, I think, some of this is a function of his having survived terrors that his compatriots didn't survive, is full of a terrible doubt that or a terrible feeling, I guess, that to praise the world in any way is to conspire with death and suffering. That it's obscene to praise life, which is so full of suffering. And yet over and over again, he praises. Anyway, that theme is interesting.
It is yours also. Mm-hmm. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I am Grace Cavalieri, and we're with Robert Haas. And we would love another poem.
A kind of wonderful example of a poetry that doesn't quite praise or dispraise is the haiku form, which I've been attached to for a long time. And I read some of these poems last night in the reading at the library, and maybe I'll read a few of them now. These are my translations of poems of Basho, who is 17th century poet, one of the great initiators of the haiku form. And the interest, Grace, of these, trying to translate these poems is to make their syntax as simple and efficient as it seems to me to be in the Japanese, though I learned the only Japanese grammar I know from trying to figure how these little magical engines worked. Well, I just got interested, you know, I read haiku as other people did and thought, God, these are amazing, and I wonder what they actually look like. So I just went out and got Japanese grammars and dictionaries and started to try to
break the code.
So I never really learned the language except the common vocabulary of these poems. So I just set myself the task of decoding one a day to see how they were put together. And after a while, I accumulated enough of them, so I thought it might make a book. Here's Basho. Even in Kyoto, hearing the cuckoos cry, I long for Kyoto. Even, I don't know if I should comment on that poem. The cuckoo is a migratory bird, of course, and it visits the islands of Japan in the springtime, and for years it was the subject of poetry, that you heard the cuckoo in the springtime in Kyoto and knew it was spring. So the poems are really a kind of sentimental idea of pure presence. And Basho says a truth about human desire. Very plain way. Even in Kyoto, hearing the cuckoos cry, I long for Kyoto. Another poem. This road, no one goes down it, autumn evening. This comes from a very early travel journal that he did. One of his forms was to mix bits of both casual and highly formed sketch prose with haiku, and this just evokes you know, an empty road in an autumn evening. He suddenly notices he's the only one there, and that's one way of reading it. This road, no one goes down it, autumn evening. Another thing that's interesting about it, once you look at the Japanese, is that Basho, like other Japanese poets, with certain words anyway, had the choice always of whether writing the word in the phonetic symbols of the Japanese syllabary. The word for road is michi. So you can either use the characters for mi and chi and make the word michi, or you can use the Chinese character. And in this poem, he chose to use the Chinese character. The Chinese character for road, michi in Japanese, is dao in Chinese. And it, of course, changes the poem visually. Can't do it in English. But you can do it by paying attention to what a deep metaphor any road that we take is. The American Lonesome Road from the blues will do. This road, no one goes down it, autumn evening.
It's all you need to hear about loneliness.
This is another one we talked about last night. All the Japanese poets, of course, wrote poems about Mount Fuji, the great subject. Here's Basho's Misty Rain, Can't See Fuji. Interesting.
Was the word interesting there?
Yeah. Some years ago was a poet in residence at the Robert Frost Farm in Franconia, New Hampshire. One of my tasks was to give a poetry reading in the barn. And my young son, who was then about 5 or 6 years old, wanted to go to the reading. And I said, if you're very good and sit quietly, we'll go to the town dump and see if we can't see some bears after the reading. So I gave the reading and I read some of these haiku translations, and he sat up straight. My friend Charles Simic read, he liked those poems. He said, I like Charlie's poems. They have rats with calculators in them. He didn't say anything about liking mine. But when we got to the dump, there were no bears, and he was disappointed. I said, we'll go get some ice cream. And we were driving back into the town in the dark, and he leaned forward and said, I think I made up a poem. And I said, let me hear it. And he said, a night of July, going to the Franconia dump to look for bears. Didn't see any.
Let me count that up. Is this Leaf?
It's Luke.
Oh, Luke. Okay.
My youngest, who's now a young man, but...
Let us have one more haiku. You know, this book is all you need for the rest of your life on your bedside table. You know, a page a night, because each one resonates so much. Mm-hmm. You can't really read that book in a hurry.
Well, let me read, without comment, a few of them. They're very short. As for the hibiscus on the roadside, my horse ate it. The oak tree, not interested in cherry blossoms. Seeing people off, being seen off, autumn in Kiso. It's not like anything they compare it to, the summer moon. This is going to get
great.
Sound. Let me find one of the better. There was one I wanted to read. And year after year, on the monkey's face, a monkey face.
I guess this moves us into the inevitable, and that is your own attention to the thing itself, mm-hmm. which is the image. Mm-hmm. And I guess a couple of your themes, they talk of your unswerving faith in the imagination and your belief and faith in the image, in the thing. So it is natural that you would have gone to haiku, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. It is your nature. It is your essence. It calls you. It is everything you believe in. It is the thing itself instead of a picture of a thing. And I wonder if you would comment on that quality you have as a poet. I see the combination of the image and the imagination, and I don't quite know how to make that relationship.
Yeah. You know, in contemporary thinking about poetry, of course, it's the big issue, because if there is anything that defines postmodernism, I suppose, it's radical skepticism. Skepticism about whether there's a world we can know, conceptual and ideological apparatus of the social worlds we're born into, you know, if there's anything, I think if there's anything that characterizes contemporary art, it's skepticism about those things. Lots of writers, you know, especially minority writers, have been unpacking the extent to which the languages we acquire already marginalize them. Gays and lesbians have been, and thinkers sympathetic to the problems that come from this, whatever their own sexual orientation, have been thinking about the ways in which the very nature of language already marginalizes any sexual relationship that doesn't look exactly like the ones that were approved by the churches in 1200. So there are millions of reasons to distrust the clear representation of the image and good reasons for distrusting them. And I think that one of the things I love about haiku is that they work very hard to create the kind of aesthetic ideal, I guess you'd say, in which one could use language as a clear mirror of the seeing of the world, which of course only happens through work. You don't get to see that way if your head is full of brain roof chatter.
And imagination.
And those, yes. So that's the connection. I mean, at some level, the common world has to be earned over and over and over again. It doesn't exist. You know, Basho, who would be in the whole history of writing the great example of this, when asked how you got to it, he said, through aesthetic madness, which meant through imagination. There's no way there without that. But the ideal, the idea that if there, whether there is one or not, our language can model a kind of attention that seems to both call the world into being and call us into being by being there. That's an act of imagination. It's not necessarily the way things are. In fact, it's not usually the way things are.
It's a hologram at best.
Yeah.
But it's how you see that.
Well, there's a Russian critic of the 20s. There was a whole group of wonderful critics in the early years of the Russian Revolution, most of whom got silenced, of course, later. This man named Eichenbaum said, the function of art is to make the grass and the stone stone.
Oh.
By freeing us from the automatism of human perception.
Oh, this is Robert Haas you are listening to, and we are at the Library of Congress. He is going to be the consultant in poetry, the Poet Laureate of the United States. I think we are going to have fun in Washington this year. He is a translator. He is an author. He is an essayist. He has won many awards, including the Danforth Fellowship, the MacArthur, and they forgot to say the Guggenheim. I think there's a few things that you've won they haven't said here. And you're on the faculty at the University of California at Berkeley, and you will be teaching there two courses this fall, but coming back and forth, I guess.
That's right. I'm going to be commuting.
And we'll be very glad of that. The books, once again, are Field Guide, Praise, Human Wishes, The Essential Haiku, and other translations. I am very interested in 20th century pleasures because when I read those essays, what I loved about them was the way you moved into them. I mean, it could be in a bar with a dirty ditty that moved into the realm of thought that you wanted to explore. It was, or else a hiking trip where you got an allergic reaction, which I myself get. And I thought how important it is for us to connect the thought with a human being. It's just as simple as that. And just to put it out there, I mean, that's showbiz. Just to put the human being up front, that hook works. I mean, it, and then whatever you think matters more to us. And I think that as you proceed through all of your life, that is in your work. The humanness is never there. It is never an abstract thought. Let's hear another poem. Let's go into spring, because you claim that you can't tell it in California. In fact, I have a friend, Judith Hall, who's the editor of the Antioch Review. She's moved to Sacramento, and she said she thinks it might be autumn, but she's planting things in case. One can't tell in California, right?
Oh, well, in fact, you can. It's a different set of signals. One of the experiences, I don't know if it's still true, of growing up in California, I think it was one of the things that made me a writer, is that in our school books, when we were children, were still printed in Boston and New York. And so Dick and Jane got their boots on and went out into the snow, and they went out and jumped up and down in piles of leaves. So I think all children growing up in California, and probably in Texas and Arizona and New Mexico and any place in the country that doesn't have northeastern weather, ends up feeling like the real children are having the real seasons.
In yellow slickers.
Someplace else. So it's not that we don't have seasons. We have them deeply, but they're somewhat different seasons, and they don't have a traditional vocabulary.
It's not orthodox, your season.
Well, I think one of the things about American art is that we haven't lived here long enough yet, you know. One of the least true things Robert Frost ever said is that the land was ours before we were the lands. I think, you know, it takes a lot of, as in these haiku, suffering in a place and living in a place. And making an art over generations and generations soaked in human life, drawing its images from those places and their actualities before you even know what they mean. I think we're still, if you look at Chinese literature or English or almost any European literature, we're still in a very early stage of our relationship to the continent, partly because we have so many diverse weathers. Anyway, this is Spring Rain. Comes from a group of poems called Spring Drawings, which were written out of, not necessarily about, the California spring. Now the rain is falling freshly in the intervals between sunlight. A Pacific squall started no one knows where, drawn east as the drifts of warm air make a channel. It moves its own way, like water or the mind, and spills this rain passing over. The Sierras will catch it as last snow flurries before summer, observed only by the wakened marmots at 10,000 feet. And we will come across it again as larkspur and penstemon sprouting along a creek above Sonora Pass next August, where the snow melt will have trickled into Dead Man's Creek, and the creek spilled into the Stanislaus, and the Stanislaus into the San Joaquin, and the San Joaquin into the slow salt marshes of the bay. That's not the end of it. The gray jays of the mountains eat larkspur seeds which cannot propagate otherwise. To simulate the process, you have to soak gathered seeds all night in the acids of coffee, and then score them gently with a very sharp knife before you plant them in the garden. You might use what was left of the coffee we drank in Lisa's kitchen visiting. There were orange poppies on the table in a clear glass vase, stained near the bottom to the color of sunrise. The unstated theme was the blessedness of gathering and the blessing of dispersal. It made you glad for beauty like that, casual and intense, lasting as long as poppies last. Another of these spring poems.
How long do poppies last?
How long do they last?
When you said that, I've read that poem, mm-hmm. and I thought, I wonder how long they last for him.
Mm-hmm.
About a month?
Well, it's interesting because the little bright orange poppies of California hillsides last quite a long time. They can last 2 or 3 months, in fact, in very unpromising circumstances. These poppies were those poppy tulips, you know.
Oh.
And once you've cut them, they, you know how they,
yes.
the sepals sort of look like artificial eye, you know, eyelashes or mascara brushes or something.
Oh, so
that fall off.
Yes, I do know those poppies. Mm-hmm. But I thought you meant this to be ambiguous.
Mm-hmm.
Because they last so many different kinds of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And this is spring in California.
Yeah.
Let's have another.
Late spring. And then in mid-May, the first morning of steady heat, the morning, Leaf says, when you wake up, put on shorts, and that's it for the day. When you pour coffee and walk outside, blinking in the sun. Strawberries have appeared in the markets, and peaches will soon. Squid is so cheap in the fish stores, you begin to consult Japanese and Italian cookbooks for the various and ingenious ways of preparing ikka and calamari. And because the light will enlarge your days, your dreams at night will be as strange as the jars of octopus you saw once in a fisherman's boat under the summer moon. And after swimming, white wine. And the sharing of stories before dinner is prolonged because the relations of the children in the neighborhood have acquired village intensity and the stories take longer telling. And there are the nights when the fog rolls in that nobody likes. Hey, fog, the Miwok sang, who lived here first. You better go home. Pelican is beating your wife. And after dark, in the first cool hour, your children sleep so heavily in their beds, exhausted from play, it is a pleasure to watch them. Leif does not move a muscle as he lies there. No, wait, it's Luke who lies there in his 8-year-old body. Leif is taller than you are, and he isn't home. When he is, his feet will extend past the end of the mattress, and Kristen is at the corner in the dark, talking to neighborhood boys. Things change. There's no need for this dream-compelled narration. The rhythm will keep us awake, changing.
From the book Human Wishes, the voice of Robert Haas. And people make a lot of your mention of food. But I think you talk about everything. I don't think that there is more food than flowers or birds in your work. I do remember, though, the green peppers on the white plate. So it is memorable. Your images of food are memorable. And I don't drink coffee, but when I read your poetry, I want coffee. So I guess it is powerful in a way I don't know. The book Human Wishes. That is the latest work.
That's
the most recent
book. It's the most recent book of poems, yes.
Right, before the one which is forthcoming, mm-hmm. which was premiered today. We are at the Library of Congress with Robert Haas, and he is from California, as you have heard. What was the title of your dissertation? I've been trying to puzzle it out. I'm thinking Blake and his printing. No, I was trying to imagine what could have caught your imagination when you were at Stanford getting a PhD.
You know, it was a very political time, and when I was thinking about doing literary scholarship and what I wanted and needed to study, I wasn't really thinking about my poetry, which was something I just did. And so I did a dissertation about the idea of ideas about the ways in which economic philosophy, that's why I was reading that hard man Thomas Hobbes on the causes of the English Civil Wars, wrote an essay on the ways in which the novel imagined the transformation of European societies in the 18th and 19th century.
Wow.
I had a couple of ideas about it. One was, I didn't have ideas about it, and I just wanted an excuse to think about the subject of how we got the kind of idea of ourselves that we have, particularly then the economic ideas. I think my starting place was kill ratios, the obsession during the Vietnam War with making sense of it by quantifying it. It was clearly, as Robert McNamara has demonstrated, written about recently in ways that are moving, or that way of thinking was a disaster. You know, it was very mistaken.
And you identify that in your dissertation.
And well, it was what got me thinking. Why do we believe that we have that our real way of making sense of the world is quantifying outcomes when so much of our behavior and so much of the reasons that we're alive don't have anything to do with that. So I was interested in the way that from the very beginning, the history of the novel took this subject on.
Oh.
So I was interested in Robinson Crusoe, oh. and I was interested in why, when Raskolnikov kills somebody in Crime and Punishment, he kills a moneylender, and that moneylender is a woman. I was interested in the fact that there were so many orphans in the history of the novel. It was, of course, a way of doing this kind of economic thinking in which people don't begin life in families. In order to have this solo competitor for the world's goods, you need to not represent the way people actually grow up.
Are you pleased with that at this day in your life? Do you look back at that work and think it's still valid?
Oh, I look back at it and think that it was a useful part of my mm-hmm. education. But I guess I wish I'd spent that time writing poems.
No, I think that it's going to stand you well in Washington. You'll be able to hold your own in anything. The new Nobel Prize winner in economics then, are you a little baffled by that theory he has? I mean, I can't really articulate it very well, but it seems pretty, it's given to someone who changes thought in economics.
Yes.
And some of them are a little difficult for me to pin to the human condition.
Yeah.
So it sounds as if your dissertation is a contribution.
Oh,
it should be
no,
published.
I mean, my dissertation was, no.
Oh, it's moral novels
take my
than economics. Take oh,
my
take
word
your word for it.
It
shouldn't be published.
No, But, you know, that kind of economic imagination is really another matter. One of my colleagues at Berkeley, Gerard Dupré, also is a Nobel Prize winner in economics. And most of them are mostly the kind of thought they change is thought about the way people do economic modelings of economic behavior.
Yes, yes.
The problem with our economics is not that we don't have very sophisticated and constantly changing ways of modeling market behavior and market activity. The problem is that we think that we have one kind of economic system, the one in which people behave rationally in a market. But in fact, sitting right next to it is this other system in which people actually behave the way they do, which doesn't have to do with calculating rational self-advantage.
I can't wait for the essays.
Using the imagination.
The essays that come out of using the imagination from your stay in Washington, mm-hmm. I think we're going to get a whole new rush on theory because you're interested in politics, you're interested in the Federalist Papers, you're interested in Madison, and I think that maybe being here is going to put you on a new platform for your writing. That'll be fun.
I think it's going to be interesting.
We are at the Library of Congress with the Poet Laureate of the United States. I like to say that. The Poet Laureate, Robert Hass. I am Grace Cavalieri, and we are going to be hearing some more poetry. What do you have for us now? Where shall we move? You have been writing and working in the field for solidly 25 years or more, 30 years, every day of your life as a writer, not sometimes a banker, sometimes a lawyer. Mm-hmm. So you must have seen what you consider a change in American letters in your own lifetime. Your own work has certainly changed. Even the line lengths have changed. What do you make of where we are right now in American poetry? If you could say a sweeping generalization.
Well, I think the generalizations that poets always make come to the same thing, which is that the generalizations aren't of much use. The sweeping generalizations that someone would have made when Emily Dickinson and Walt Whitman were alive would have been about how magnificent the poetry of Longfellow and Whittier were. We don't know in what closet the poems that are going to most deeply nourish our culture are. I don't know if you can ever see clearly in the present. So with that,
that was general enough for me.
Proviso. One of the things because of the all the stuff that has been going on in Congress with the National Endowment for the Arts and National Endowment for the Humanities, I've heard lots of speeches in which people say the arts in America are in trouble, and I always think they are. It's news to me. Do people really think that in the future they're going to remember this as the age of Jesse Helms or the age of Toni Morrison? There are great writers working among us, doing great work. It's not by accident that the last four Nobel Prize winners, none of whom were Americans, live and work in this country. Three of the four are American citizens. This has been a place enormously hospitable to poetry. We've had, after how many years between Contact and 1965, let's say, there was very little Native American poetry in English. Suddenly, there's a really interesting body of new work in poetry and fiction from Native American peoples. In my part of the world, there's been the sudden creation of the voice of Asian American writers.
And the Latin influx, the second immigration, is incredibly influencing our work. Yes.
So there's an interesting new generation of postmodern writers, experimental writers, mainly concentrated in places like New York and San Francisco. I think there's a tremendous amount of liveliness in American writing right now.
Is that what you call postmodern, is experimental?
Well, yeah, I think there are different kinds of experiment, but I would say about, a quick way of thinking about postmodern work is that it always has an element of questioning the materials of the art, exploring questions around what the art can do.
And accumulating a lot of it. Different kinds.
So there's dazzling work being done to name just a couple of writers and a couple of books for people who are interested in that sort of difficult, playful work at the edges, work that's like jazz. Some of these writers are going to be coming to the library right now. I recently saw an anthology of poetry and poetry about jazz, and one of the things that struck me about it is there were an enormous number of poems about jazz and jazz musicians.
Was that from Indiana?
Yeah. But almost none of them were like jazz. They were about jazz.
Oh, yes. You are very right. Now, who are the writers who are writing poetry like jazz?
Well, two who occur to me and who are going to be in this series are a woman named Lynn Hajenian, whose husband is a jazz musician, who, if you want to see what this kind of writing is like at its most dazzling and demanding, has written a book that I think is one of the most interesting in my generation of poets, called My Life. It's a prose work, prose poetry, I guess, or in some borderland between prose and poetry. And the other is Michael Palmer, he's like those jazz musicians who play chords all around the melody, never quite play, don't want to play the melody. And he's extremely interesting in that way. There are at the same time powerful writers working in the realist tradition. So anyway, I would say a couple of other things. There are 900 books of poetry published in this country every year, three a day. There are 400 poetry magazines on the internet. I think part of the groundwork for this interest got laid by the work that's been done by our cultural institutions, including the NEA.
I do too.
Poetry is alive and flourishing in this country, and people will find out just by going into their bookstores and looking at the poetry shelves.
And we love having you as a spokesperson for it. I know you do not write occasional poetry. However, you did honor Justice Brennan with a poem, and I wonder if you'd share that with us, because I think it's a very nice official thing to do.
Sure.
This is Robert Hass. We're at the Library of Congress. It is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress.
The American Civil Liberties Union asked me if I would write something for the occasion of their presenting a Lifetime Achievement Award to Justice Brennan. I didn't think I could do it, but I was looking at the deer moving through the winter woods in Iowa, and thinking about what I admire about his prose. And so this is Jurisprudence, or The Woods in New Jersey, which is where Justice Brennan was born. Where there was only gray and grayish brown and brownish gray against the white of fallen snow at twilight in the winter woods. Now an uncanny flame-like thing, black and sulfur yellow, as if it were a dream of Audubon's, is turned upside down in a delicate cascade of new green leaves, feeding on whatever mites or small white spiders haunt the undersides of leaves at stem end. A magnolia warbler, to give the thing a name. The other name we give this excessive appetite and beauty unconscious of itself is life. And that kept the mind becalmed all winter, the more abstract, the more austere and abstract rhythms of the trunk's vertical music the cold makes visible that holds the whole thing up and gives it form or strength. Call that the law. It's made, whatever we like to think, more of interest than of reasons, trees reaching each their own way for the light to make a sort of order unawares. And what of those deer threading through the woods in a late snowfall and silent as the snow? They are the mind, I think, in jurisprudence or in art. Look, they move among the winter trees, so much the color of the trees, they hardly seem to move.
Robert Haas, the program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Our guest has been the Poet Laureate of the United States, the Poet Laureate Consultant in Poetry. We wish to thank the Motion Picture, Broadcasting, and Sound Division of the Library of Congress. This program has been made possible by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry and by WPFW in Washington. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our engineer is Mike Turpin.